Part 3. In this part, you will hear two segments from a radio program. After each segment, you will hear six questions about it. Before each segment begins, you will have time to preview the questions. You will hear each segment twice. Then you will hear the questions once. If you want to, you may take notes as you listen. You should mark A, B, or C. Do you have any questions? Look at the questions, then listen to the first segment. Now you will hear the first segment.
We're all familiar with the damaging effects of the sun and its potential to cause skin cancer. So how much protection can we expect from sunscreens? Bob Newman reports.
Most of us think that as long as we use a sunscreen, the risks of tanning will be minimized. But unfortunately, it's not as simple as that. Not only are some sunscreens potentially toxic, but also the way in which we apply them may do us more harm than good. Dermatologist Dr. Nora Henderson explains.
All sunscreens have an SPF number, and it's important to understand what that means. The SPF, or sun protection factor, relates to the length of time it takes for unprotected skin to burn from exposure to the sun's ultraviolet rays. For example, if it takes 30 minutes before your skin starts going red, and you apply a sunscreen with an SPF of 15, you'll be protected for 7.5 hours, 15 times longer than without sunscreen. However, what people don't know is that a very high SPF gives us a false sense of security. Sunscreen with an SPF of 60, for example, provides only minimal additional protection. And because it contains a higher concentration of chemicals than sunscreens with a low SPF, it may have harmful effects on the skin. Many sunscreens contain chemicals which, in laboratory tests on rats, were found to disrupt hormones and affect the development of the brain. Now, there are some sun protection products, such as sunblocks, which contain minerals instead of chemicals. Sunblocks are usually in the form of a thick white cream, which blocks out all UV rays. But if you choose to use sunscreen, which is easier for the skin to absorb, an SPF of 15 is quite adequate.
Dr. Henderson, what about the question of how much and how often? People frequently make the mistake of applying sunscreen too thinly. Because it's expensive, we're tempted to use it sparingly.
That's true. In fact, most of us apply only a fifth to a half as much cream as we should. As for how often, according to a study at a British university, we get the best protection if we apply sunscreen liberally 15 to 30 minutes before going out into the sun. And this should be followed by reapplication quite soon, another 15 to 30 minutes after sun exposure begins, with more being applied if we engage in any activity that could remove the sunscreen, such as swimming, drying off with a towel, or anything that makes you sweat a lot. And finally, don't forget to use sunscreen on overcast days too. Only 20% of radiation is blocked by clouds.
Of course, we shouldn't be afraid to spend time outdoors. After all, sunlight helps our bodies produce vitamin D. But it's important for the whole family to protect their skin, especially the younger generation. They won't see the effects of sun damage until they reach their 40s and 50s. By then, it's too late to do anything about it.
Now you will hear the segment again.
We're all familiar with the damaging effects of the sun and its potential to cause skin cancer. So how much protection can we expect from sunscreens? Bob Newman reports.
Most of us think that as long as we use a sunscreen, the risks of tanning will be minimized. But unfortunately, it's not as simple as that. Not only are some sunscreens potentially toxic, but also the way in which we apply them may do us more harm than good. Dermatologist Dr. Nora Henderson explains.
All sunscreens have an SPF number, and it's important to understand what that means. The SPF, or sun protection factor, relates to the length of time it takes for unprotected skin to burn from exposure to the sun's ultraviolet rays. For example, if it takes 30 minutes before your skin starts going red, and you apply a sunscreen with an SPF of 15, you'll be protected for 7.5 hours, 15 times longer than without sunscreen. However, what people don't know is that a very high SPF gives us a false sense of security. Sunscreen with an SPF of 60, for example, provides only minimal additional protection. And because it contains a higher concentration of chemicals than sunscreens with a low SPF, it may have harmful effects on the skin. Many sunscreens contain chemicals which, in laboratory tests on rats, were found to disrupt hormones and affect the development of the brain. Now, there are some sun protection products, such as sunblocks, which contain minerals instead of chemicals. Sunblocks are usually in the form of a thick white cream, which blocks out all UV rays. But if you choose to use sunscreen, which is easier for the skin to absorb, an SPF of 15 is quite adequate.
Dr. Henderson, what about the question of how much and how often? People frequently make the mistake of applying sunscreen too thinly. Because it's expensive, we're tempted to use it sparingly.
That's true. In fact, most of us apply only a fifth to a half as much cream as we should. As for how often, according to a study at a British university, we get the best protection if we apply sunscreen liberally 15 to 30 minutes before going out into the sun. And this should be followed by reapplication quite soon, another 15 to 30 minutes after sun exposure begins, with more being applied if we engage in any activity that could remove the sunscreen, such as swimming, drying off with a towel, or anything that makes you sweat a lot. And finally, don't forget to use sunscreen on overcast days too. Only 20% of radiation is blocked by clouds.
Of course, we shouldn't be afraid to spend time outdoors. After all, sunlight helps our bodies produce vitamin D. But it's important for the whole family to protect their skin, especially the younger generation. They won't see the effects of sun damage until they reach their 40s and 50s. By then, it's too late to do anything about it.
Number 39. What does the SPF number on a sunscreen tell you? Number 40. What problem with high SPF sunscreens does Dr. Henderson mention? Number 41. What reason does the reporter give for why some people don't apply enough sunscreen? Number 42. What does Dr. Henderson imply about applying sunscreen? Number 43. Why is it so important to protect young people's skin? Number 44. What is the main purpose of this report? Look at the questions, then listen to the second segment. Now you will hear the second segment.
Have you ever heard of cryonics? Probably not, unless you're a fan of science fiction. For more on this fascinating topic, here is Stan Martin.
Those of you who have heard of cryonics may well shudder at the thought of it. Cryonics is the practice of preserving bodies at low temperatures until scientists and doctors develop the techniques to cure whatever condition resulted in their death. This may be 50 to 100 years in the future, or maybe more. With me to take a closer look at this process are our medical correspondent George Saunders and Dr. Roberta Edwards, an expert in cryonics. Thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
George, can you give our listeners an idea of how widely cryonics is used in the U.S.?
Of course. There are several facilities that cater to people who are believers in the power of future technology. The patients, as they are called, are preserved in liquid nitrogen in giant fiberglass cases. All this might sound pretty bizarre to most of us, but hundreds of people have chosen to be frozen in the hope that one day, scientists will revive them using some as yet undiscovered advanced technology.
And how does cryonics actually work, Dr. Edwards?
Well, once the patient is pronounced legally dead, the body has to be cooled down as quickly as possible. The first stage involves removing the blood and replacing it with a solution containing glycerol. This acts in the same way as antifreeze fluid does in a car. It minimizes the damage caused by freezing. A machine keeps the heart going in order to circulate this solution while the body is cooled down to dry ice temperature of minus 110 degrees Fahrenheit. The next stage is to freeze the body to minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit, which protects it indefinitely from decay.
But so far, no one has been resuscitated, have they, George? And many scientists are deeply skeptical. So why is this seen by some as the best chance of life after death?
Well, advocates of cryonics point to examples in nature, such as the Canadian woodland frog. This reptile literally freezes through the winter and then thaws out in spring with no ill effects.
But we should mention that the wood frog's metabolism is built to cope with that process, unlike humans. When water inside of most plants and animals freezes, it expands, destroying cells in the process. What makes the wood frog so unique is that before it freezes, its body goes through a process which ensures that its cells will be unharmed. It's this aspect of cryonics that makes many scientists so skeptical, especially experts in the field of cryobiology, which is the study of body tissues at low temperatures. They say that only individual cells, under laboratory conditions, can be frozen and revived successfully, such as living sperm and fertilized embryos, both of which are a far cry from preserving a whole body. The brain alone is an incredibly fragile structure, and there is nothing to suggest that the cryonic techniques currently being used can preserve the brain well enough to enable it to function properly if it were one day revived.
So can cryonics really work, or will it always remain in the realm of fantasy? Well, we'll probably have to wait 100 years for the answer to that one.
Now you will hear the segment again.
Have you ever heard of cryonics? Probably not, unless you're a fan of science fiction. For more on this fascinating topic, here is Stan Martin.
Those of you who have heard of cryonics may well shudder at the thought of it. Cryonics is the practice of preserving bodies at low temperatures until scientists and doctors develop the techniques to cure whatever condition resulted in their death. This may be 50 to 100 years in the future, or maybe more. With me to take a closer look at this process are our medical correspondent George Saunders and Dr. Roberta Edwards, an expert in cryonics. Thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
George, can you give our listeners an idea of how widely cryonics is used in the U.S.?
Of course. There are several facilities that cater to people who are believers in the power of future technology. The patients, as they are called, are preserved in liquid nitrogen in giant fiberglass cases. All this might sound pretty bizarre to most of us, but hundreds of people have chosen to be frozen in the hope that one day, scientists will revive them using some as yet undiscovered advanced technology.
And how does cryonics actually work, Dr. Edwards?
Well, once the patient is pronounced legally dead, the body has to be cooled down as quickly as possible. The first stage involves removing the blood and replacing it with a solution containing glycerol. This acts in the same way as antifreeze fluid does in a car. It minimizes the damage caused by freezing. A machine keeps the heart going in order to circulate this solution while the body is cooled down to dry ice temperature of minus 110 degrees Fahrenheit. The next stage is to freeze the body to minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit, which protects it indefinitely from decay.
But so far, no one has been resuscitated, have they, George? And many scientists are deeply skeptical. So why is this seen by some as the best chance of life after death?
Well, advocates of cryonics point to examples in nature, such as the Canadian woodland frog. This reptile literally freezes through the winter and then thaws out in spring with no ill effects.
But we should mention that the wood frog's metabolism is built to cope with that process, unlike humans. When water inside of most plants and animals freezes, it expands, destroying cells in the process. What makes the wood frog so unique is that before it freezes, its body goes through a process which ensures that its cells will be unharmed. It's this aspect of cryonics that makes many scientists so skeptical, especially experts in the field of cryobiology, which is the study of body tissues at low temperatures. They say that only individual cells, under laboratory conditions, can be frozen and revived successfully, such as living sperm and fertilized embryos, both of which are a far cry from preserving a whole body. The brain alone is an incredibly fragile structure, and there is nothing to suggest that the cryonic techniques currently being used can preserve the brain well enough to enable it to function properly if it were one day revived.
So can cryonics really work, or will it always remain in the realm of fantasy? Well, we'll probably have to wait 100 years for the answer to that one.
Number 45. According to the reporter, what is cryonics? Number 46. What does George Saunders say about cryonics facilities? Number 47. What does Dr. Edwards say happens to the body during the cryonic process? Number 48. Why do supporters of cryonics think the practice is feasible? Number 49. According to Dr. Edwards, what do critics of cryonics maintain? Number 50. What is the main purpose of this report? End of listening test.